You do? And we are now going to return to the exciting world of psychological testing. By the way, the people who are doing all the technical work for us have asked if you really make sure you use the mic when you ask a question. They're picking up some of it, but they're not picking up everything. So if you could do that, it would be very helpful. Now, you know, we were talking about psychological testing, and I was, you know, trying to make the contrast that there really are very different ways to approach getting information from people. And if you remember, we talked about, first of all, you know, intelligence testing, where, while that's a very complex variable, the reality is we're looking for one thing, and often the test is simply expressed in terms of a score, and everybody gets the same test, and they either score higher or lower depending on how they answer questions or how they perform on these various subtests. Then we went on and we talked about personality tests and objective personality tests like the MMPI, where everybody gets the same questions and they answer them either true or false, and those items are scored in such a way that you will either score higher on scales of abnormal behavior or psychopathology, or you will score lower. In that particular test, you know, some of the advantages were you can just give the person the test. They spend their time, an hour perhaps or more, taking the test. You can machine score it, and then the scores come back. And you are comparing someone directly against other people who took the same test and who perhaps by an independent measure have been shown to have a certain problem. And that, you know, kind of test is widely used. And I mentioned there are other tests like that, the 16-PF test, which was the one that Cattell developed, and we did not spend any time on it, but just so you'll know, there are other such tests. MMPI is by far the most famous. Then we got talking about the projective techniques yesterday. Now, that's very different, because if you recall, you know, in projective techniques, like we did our Rorschach here, well, if today we had several other students here, and none of you participated, but we had our other students participate, you would get different responses to the Rorschach. And you would find that people would see different things. You would find that people would use the plots differently. Remember yesterday I was pointing out how in this group, you know, people used color, and people used the whole blot, and people saw motion. Often, people don't, especially people who are really struggling, don't use the whole blot, can't respond to color. Color, by the way, the response to color usually means one's response to emotion. But you get very different responses, and the test is highly dependent on the ability of the clinician who has given many, many of these tests. Both like the Rorschach, we also did our thematic apperception test, the TAT, to be able to recognize the dynamics in a person from either the responses they're given to, you know, some very unstructured stimulus like an ink blot, or the kind of story they tell, and whether their stories are optimistic or pessimistic, whether the people in the stories are feeling positive or negative, whether the person sees the circumstances leading up to the story as being positive or negative, whether the person thinks that when the story ends, there will be either a good ending or a positive ending, or perhaps they're very ambivalent and uncertain. So these latter tests, that is projective tests, are much more dependent on the ability of a skilled examiner to be able to draw inferences. The same was true as we took our sentence completion test. Now, there's just one other projective test that I want to familiarize you with, because you have probably heard of it and seen it used, and that's the draw a person test. Now, the draw a person test is called a projective technique. It's gotten lots of attention, And sometimes the instructions are given, usually the instructions are simply, you ask the person, you ask, that is the client, draw a person. And you get various responses. Sometimes people will simply draw an individual. Others will draw an individual in a context. So they'll put the person perhaps in a family. And usually the examiner, if the person doesn't, you know, put the individual in a context, then you may ask them to draw a second picture. And depending on the age of the person and depending on what you might want, you might tell them to draw a picture of the family. The family could be for a child, you know, a picture that would include mom and dad and siblings. For someone who's married, it might be including a spouse and your children. But the idea is, of course, to get a sense of how the main person, and you assume the main person in the drawing is our is the person being examined, and you ask the person if you're not certain, you know, like which one of these characters is you. But you do get to see clinically a lot of things. For example, sometimes a person draws, you know, an individual, but the person doesn't have ears. And the person may have very, very difficult to determine even the eyes. And you get a sense, this person doesn't want a lot of input. This person has a very primitive, you know, kind of individual that they're presenting to you, that they don't feel sharp, that they don't feel alert, that maybe they don't want information. On the other hand, you may have someone who draws the family, and they draw a picture of a lot of animation, mom and dad, kids all interacting, but our person is off to the side. You know, in other words, this person doesn't feel that he or she is really integrated into the family. They may actually see the family somewhat positively. That is, the other people all seem to be involved with each other, but here's our person who is a loner. You can do that, by the way, with ask them to draw a class at school and see where they place themselves. But the idea with the draw person is to get a sense of what the person thinks of themselves. Sometimes they will have, you know, an exaggerated head or a very tiny head. You know, sometimes they will try to go into detail with their body shape. Sometimes they just do a stick figure. Now, there actually are scoring systems for the draw person, but they're highly dependent on the clinician being able to make certain inferences about what the drawings mean. And most of the time, people who use the draw person test don't score it. The same way as I was mentioning, most of the time people don't score Rorschach's, and most of the time they don't score TAT tests or sentence completion tests. What happens with those tests is the clinician simply uses them based on his or her experience to obtain more information about a person. Sometimes it's to obtain diagnostic information, like one thinks that this person might be schizophrenic. And by giving these tests, you already have had a lot of experience with how schizophrenic people will respond to the test versus how non-schizophrenic people respond. And so if you suspect the person might be schizophrenic, and you want to be very careful and you test them, sometimes you find out they're not schizophrenic. That while they look very fragile, and that is psychologically fragile, and you think that this person looks so primitive they might be schizophrenic, you find out that's not the case. You find out they're very frightened, that they have a great deal of anxiety, that they have withdrawn because of this anxiety. But diagnostically, it's very important to know that that's what the issue is and that they're not schizophrenic. It's especially true if one was going to use medication, because you wouldn't want to start using antipsychotic medication or medication that we typically use for schizophrenics if you don't have somebody who's schizophrenic. So the tests often are very helpful in determining, first of all, the kind of psychopathology a person has, and in, you know, creating a sense of what are the first steps in treatment that one might take. And now tests, of course, some of these tests are used, you know, in the extremes, when you're trying to determine, you know, if somebody has enough control of their impulses, let's say, to operate outside of a hospital. And so if you have someone who is in an emergency room, they look like they're just terribly out of control, you put them on an inpatient unit, the question becomes how many days are they going to be there. Sometimes you test them to get a sense of what kind of psychological resources does this person have, how quickly can this person perhaps move to get integrated and then be able to operate outside of a hospital. Now, we've already talked earlier about concepts when we were talking about interviewing, and I said that interviewing and testing will have some of the same statistical concepts, that is reliability and validity, so I'm not going to go over them again. But you should know that tests, in terms of being scientific, one would want tests to be quite reliable and we would want tests to be quite valid. Statistically speaking, tests like the MMPI have been shown. I mean, we know what the reliability of the MMPI is. We know we have validity scores on it. We have validity scores on all of its subtests. We have a great deal of statistical information on that. We have less information of that sort on the projectives. There is a well-known psychologist, John Exner, E-X-N-E-R. John Exner has clearly developed probably the most sophisticated current scoring system and the most used scoring system right now for the Rorschach. And we do have information on its reliability and validity. And if one is going to score it, probably that's a scoring system you will use. We have much less sophisticated data on the MMPI. We have data on sentence completion tests, and sentence completion tests have been shown to be reliable and valid tests if they're focused on certain characteristics. That is, if the score you're looking for is an ego strength score, you can develop one for a sentence completion test. You can develop one for interpersonal effectiveness. So there are some things that already have been tried, and we know scientifically how valid they are. There's a scoring system for the draw a person test, not really well established. What you would want to know, though, and this is something that's not discussed enough, the four psychological tests where we have established and done, good work scientifically so that we know whether it is a reliable and valid test. Psychological tests tend to be about as reliable and valid as most medical tests. And when you say that, that for some people that can become frightening because you want to think of medical tests as being absolutely valid. I mean, you either have this ulcer or you don't have it. You either have some problem with your blood or you don't. But medical tests, as you know, can have errors the same way psychological tests do. The medical tests, often are very good in the sense that most of the time they're right, but they're not always right. The same thing with psychological tests. Often, you see someone on MMPI with a very high D score, a very high depression score, and then you see they have an elevated manic score and a greatly decreased social introversion score, you do have to worry that this person's going to be suicidal because you've got someone who's terribly depressed, but you've got someone who's trying to act out all kinds of impulses, and the worry you have to have is that that person really is going to take their life. So, the tests can be really helpful with very real-world clinical problems. And as I say, psychology has been working very hard to try to make these tests more and more effective, better predictors. But always, there will be the room for error. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. Now, there are also are abuses of tests. And one of the abuses is when people try to get more from a test than the test can deliver. One time, I don't know if I've mentioned this to you before, I was testing a high school, wanted to determine a scholarship. They had one scholarship to offer. Someone had given the test. It was a private school. And they wanted to decide, you know, how who should get it. And they gave the usual tests, you know, young people take to get into high school. They found two outstanding students. And they couldn't decide which of these students to give this to. So they asked me if I would give them each student an IQ test, an individual IQ test. And so I saw these two students and I gave them the IQ test. And one youngster scored, I think, in the low 150s, maybe like IQ of 151, 152. The other youngster had about 144. So you got two really bright kids. But when these youngsters came for the test, the kid who had in the low 150s, he came with mom and dad wearing a suit. This is an eighth grade kid now, wearing a suit. And the kid comes in and he says, "Where do I sit? And is this the right place? Do I have the right kind of pen?" And the parents are saying, "Now, you concentrate there. You know, you listen to the doctor. You work very hard." And this kid was a wreck. The other kid comes in. This kid comes in dressed like you expect an eighth grader. You know, the kid's got a nice shirt on, and he comes in, and he greets me. And he had really liked this high school, so he had been to games there and stuff like that. You know, he was very comfortable in place, and no one was with him. Came on his own, took the bus. And he comes in, and he gets talking to me about the football team at the school and how excited he is and how pleased he is he's going to have a chance to come to this high school. This kid sits down and says, "Well, what would you like me to do?" And he takes the test, and he's very comfortable taking the test. So afterwards, I tell the principal of the school, "You know, you've got two very bright kids here. And one scored somewhat higher than the other. But the kid who scored the high, the 151, 152 IQ, this is a very neurotic kid. And this kid is really being driven, I mean, to excel. I mean, he's not having any fun being bright. He's a really bright kid, really talented kid. He's having no fun. And the parents are putting tremendous pressure on him." I said, "The other kid is, not only is this other kid bright, but this kid enjoys life. He enjoys learning. He's a youngster who's going to do very well here. He's not only going to do very well here in school, my guess is this youngster will probably become president of the student council. He'll be very popular with his peers. And, you know, you would probably do the kid with 150 plus IQ a favor by not giving him the scholarship. Because if you give him the scholarship, this kid is going to feel pressured to perform at a very high level so he doesn't lose the scholarship. The parents will be on him saying, now you've really got to, you know, keep on excelling, etc." So anyway, I find out about a week later, I ask, "You know, who did you give the scholarship to?" "Gave it to the kid who had 151. "Why did you do that?" "Because he had 151. And we weren't going to give a kid with 144 the scholarship when another kid got 151. Total misuse of tests. A very narrow, concrete kind of thinking about trying to make a decision. Had I known that, I should never have agreed to test. Because the test, when they originally put it forward, was to determine which of these two youngsters would be best to get the scholarship. It then changed, and it didn't become which of these two youngsters you're testing would be the best youngster to get the scholarship, but instead it became which of these two is going to get the highest number on an IQ test. That's the kid that's going to get the scholarship. That's a misuse of tests. That's really not the way we should operate with these tests. Now, I've also mentioned to you that there are biases in some of these tests against minorities. Gave you the example of the graduate student who came to me because of Native Americans and how they would score on the MMPI, and how she was saying, you know, I mean, all Cherokees would answer this thing in the pathological direction, or certainly almost all Cherokees. So what's happened is many tests have become devalued because we have already found certain biases in them. And it's interesting because sometimes the tests aren't biased. Actually, the tests give a very accurate picture, but our society doesn't want to accept it. A great one is in the ACT. There's a lot of criticism of the ACT, of young people taking it, you know, to get into college, because women score significantly lower on the math part of the ACT. I mean, in fact, there are different scores for women than for men, and women's scores are lower. And I remember a real public argument one time when I was at another university where I was the provost, and the chancellor of the university, who was a real expert on this stuff, is in an argument at the Board of Regents with the regents. The regents are saying, a female regent, very bright woman too, a woman who had a doctorate, but she was saying, this test is biased against women. You should not be using this test to determine who gets into college. The chancellor said, this test is absolutely not biased against women. She said, well, you're crazy. I mean, we know statistically women score significantly lower on this math test than men do. He said, that's true. And that's because women are lower. Women are less prepared in math. Women score lower on the math subtest because they don't take all the math courses that men take. The test is not biased. The women really are less prepared. Well, that just infuriated the regent, because the regent wanted to believe that this is a bias against women. That women, and the regent's point was, I mean, if you were to sit down and talk with her, was that women are as bright as men. Now, the chancellor would have said, of course women are as bright as men. That's not in question. What is in question is, who is better at math? And who is better at math is being determined by how well prepared were you in math. Well, if you got a bunch of guys taking the test who in high school got a chance to take calculus, and women were all discouraged from taking calculus, they're also discouraged from taking trig and solid geometry, so maybe they stopped after advanced algebra, they aren't going to score as well on the test. So it's not a test bias. It's a cultural bias in how we relate to women students. And this argument, by the way, you know, has been acted out in a lot of places. It's been very healthy, because finally we're realizing that we have to try to create an environment in high school where women feel as comfortable taking science and math as men do. And by having women pushed out of science and math courses with the idea that those are men's fields, women are tremendously disadvantaged coming into the university. And it's interesting, too, if you talk to women who went to private all-girls schools, many more of them will have taken physics and chemistry, taken trig, taken calculus, because they're not in that environment where supposedly these are for the guys. And in fact, in those kind of schools where the focus is on really trying to develop women so that they'll do very well in college, there's a lot of insistence that they take these advanced math and science courses. But those, you know, when those things happen, it becomes very important to understand that in some cases, like the test is misused, in the example I gave you about high school. In the other case that we just discussed, there is nothing wrong with the test. The test is simply reflecting reality. And the reality is, at least was up until recently, since women take so much less math, they are not going to score well in a math exam. It has nothing to do with are they bright. It has everything to do with have they been exposed, are they prepared. Because these tests measure kind of your exposure. Now also, I mentioned to you not long ago that in the case with minorities scoring poorly on tests, that at least in a number of cases we've found that that's really been a mistake to assume that because someone belongs to a certain race, that is the reason they scored low on entrance exams. And it's been, and there are good studies to show that the better variable rather than race is socioeconomic status. That is, those people who live in very poor communities and go to schools that don't get the support that wealthier communities get, regardless of their race, those students tend not to do as well. You know, if you don't have the most current books, you don't have current labs, you don't have teachers who are as motivated, and those teachers aren't paid as well, and you can go on with a lot of other variables, it's not surprising that those youngsters may not do as well in school as others. And if you add to that, often in poorer families, regardless of what race you're in, kids work because the family needs the kids to work. In other more affluent families, the kids may not work. The kids may really have all their time to give to school. So they may get a chance to read more. They may get a chance to take more courses. So they're going to score higher. And because the lower socioeconomic class is more populated with minorities, that jump that minority status has something to do with it is unfortunately a very bad choice. And I think we're finally realizing that. Now, I want to talk with you about something that is related to psychological testing, and it's a very unusual case. How many of you are familiar with the Supreme Court case of Brown versus the Board of Education? Pardon? That's the desegregation case. Okay, Ms. Hofstadter, you said you're familiar. What can you tell us about it? Okay, it actually is Linda Brown. Is actually the Brown is a young girl. But yes, that's what the issue is about. Did you have something you wanted to add to that, Ms. Breaux? You just knew that it was a desegregation case. Okay. Well, there are a number of legal scholars, you know, and constitutional lawyers who have argued that the case of Brown versus the Board of Education is the most important United States Supreme Court decision of the 20th century. Some have even argued it's the most important Supreme Court decision of all time. And you might say, okay, so this is the case that had to do with integrating the schools. What does this have to do with psychological testing? It has a tremendous amount to do. This is really important history. And let me take you back to earlier to kind of set the tone for this. Back in 1896, the U.S. Supreme Court made a decision in a case called Plessy versus Ferguson. And what the Supreme Court said was that you could have segregated schools as long as the schools for blacks were equivalent to the schools for whites. That was the decision that was made. Now, and by the way, you know, that was challenged. I mean, for a long time this was challenged in the Supreme Court, which tends to rule on the basis of what they decided before. So once they make a bad decision, it's very difficult to get them to give that up. So for, you know, more than 50 years, the Supreme Court kept saying that it's really okay to segregate children on the basis of race as long as you give them equal opportunities. Now, in 1954, in this really famous case where Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court of the United States, in a unanimous decision, and this is a very important, that the Supreme Court voted 9-0 that the Plessy versus Ferguson decision had to be struck down. And the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and this is really an interesting story, was Earl Warren. Now, Earl Warren had only been the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court for 2 months. He'd only been on the Supreme Court for 7 months. And here he was now, he was leading the court, and he writes the decision for the court. And in his decision, he says, and this is a quote, "Segregation of white and colored children in public schools has a detrimental effect on the colored children. The impact is greater when it has the sanction of law. For the policy of separating the races is usually interpreted as denoting the inferiority of the Negro group. A sense of inferiority affects the motivation of the child to learn. Segregation, with the sanction of law, therefore, has a tendency to retard the educational and mental development of Negro children and to deprive them of the benefits they would have received in a racially integrated school. Now, this is a key sentence. Whatever may have been the extent of psychological knowledge at the time of Plessy versus Ferguson, this new finding is amply supported by modern authority, and the reference is to psychology here. Now, it just goes on to say, any language in Plessy versus Ferguson contrary to this finding is rejected. We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. This was Earl Warren writing for the Supreme Court. Now, in that section,
Dr. Sheridan,
sure,
is that in our book, or where can we find that?
I'll give you a reference. Right at the end, I'll put it up on a slide where you can read more about this. I'm glad you asked that. Now, that reference that was made to psychological knowledge actually is footnoted in this opinion, and it refers to the research of Dr. Kenneth B. Clark, who at that time was an assistant professor of psychology at New York University, actually at City University, at the City University of New York. And Dr. Clark, who himself is an African-American psychologist, had conducted the research that was used in the argument to overthrow this Plessy versus Ferguson finding. Now, the research is fascinating, and I'll give you a couple of references where you could read about this. But what happened was that Dr. Clark visited a number of schools in the southern United States. These were all segregated states. And he tested children. And it's important to know that when Dr. Clark went, he often went into small towns. So they had these dreary schoolhouses where the black children were being educated. And he would sit down with these children, and he had these dolls. Some of the dolls were black, some of the dolls were white. And actually, this test had been developed by Dr. Clark's wife, who also had a PhD in psychology. And he would give the dolls to the black children, and he would have them do things like, he would have them play with them. He would ask them questions about, you know, which one they liked. And he would have them tell stories about them, etc. Consistently, what he found was that the black children liked the white dolls better. They attributed many more positive things to the white dolls, and they attributed many more negative things to the black dolls. And so he used this information to draw the conclusion that children being segregated and children being, seeing the white kids, who, by the way, you know, had better schools and more modern books and things like that, but that the black children were greatly disadvantaged. And by being disadvantaged, they weren't going to learn as well. They were less motivated. They had less hope. And a lot of other things. And also, you know, in his, he had things like, you know, which of these dolls would you like to keep and which one would you not want? And most of the time, the black children would want to keep the white dolls and they would reject the black dolls. I mean, very kind of touching, powerful things. And also, to add to the drama of this, when you read this history, the segregationists in the South were mean people. And they found out that Dr. Clark, was doing this, and they realized that he was, you know, doing this testing to make a point. And so he, many times when he went into a town, he went in, tested these children, and he had to get out of town as fast as he could before the sheriff found he was there, because he would have been arrested for some charge. Obviously, he wasn't doing anything illegal, but, you know, back in those days, if you were black, you didn't have to be doing anything illegal to be in trouble. And it reads, it's a tremendous saga, Now, some of the travel he did, he also did with the attorney who was trying to make the case for getting rid of segregated schools. Do you know who the attorney was? Who? No? Not, pardon? Thurgood Marshall. That's right. Thurgood Marshall, the first African American to ever sit on the Supreme Court. He was a young lawyer. He was working for the federal government. And he went with Dr. Clark and was very much trying to build up this case that this Plessy versus Ferguson argument made no sense. And it was tremendously disadvantaged to black children. And so the case becomes important then for psychologists because it's the first time that psychological science was used to determine a Supreme Court case. And we're not just talking about a Supreme Court case, but we're talking about a momentous Supreme Court case. And it's interesting, when the case came out, and of course it's 9-0. I mean, and when you read the history of this, by the way, they didn't start out 9-0. There were Supreme Court justices, all of whom were white males, by the way, at that time, who felt that this is not, we shouldn't get into this. It'll cause all kinds of turmoil. Besides that, you know, the evidence is not that strong. And one of the things is they never made a finding on the basis of psychological science. I mean, the law argued from the law. Here is an argument being made from the basis of social science data and psychological science, and from the psychological testing done by this African-American psychologist. But Warren kept going around talking to the justices who weren't ready to vote yes. And he held up actually taking a vote till he had it 9-0, because he wanted to be sure that the impact in the Brown case was that no one could say, well, the Supreme Court split. I mean, this is still controversial. He wanted to say, there is no controversy. There will be no segregation in the schools. Now, as you know, a lot of things came from this. Thurgood Marshall, of course, became famous. He was the person who argued the case before the Supreme Court, he and one other attorney. And of course, the impact was such that he eventually went on to become a member of the Supreme Court. Now, I would also mention that, you know, touching if you see pictures of this. Brown actually is Oliver Brown. That is, but Oliver Brown is the father of Linda Brown. Linda Brown is the grade school student who is the plaintiff in this case. And the father, Oliver Brown, brings the case because he feels his daughter, Linda, is going to experience an inferior education if she has to go to segregated black schools. And when Thurgood Marshall brought the case, he actually brought it as a class action suit. And he involved South Carolina, Virginia, Delaware, and of course Kansas, where Linda Brown was. And so it had a sweeping effect because it was not just a case like focused on Kansas, but it was focused on even deep South states. And it was an absolutely unanimous decision that this is what should happen. Now, I'll tell you a very interesting historical note about this. I don't know that you would know this, but I will check with you. Do you know who Earl Warren was? Do you know, besides being the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court? Is that a familiar name? Okay.
All I know is that I heard about the Warren Court, like some of the things that he's...
Yes.
I don't know the details of it, but I know he had like a long legacy in terms of some of the things he did within the Supreme Court, but I don't know much.
Well, no, Mr. Pooney, that's very good. The Warren Court, often the Supreme Court is referred to by the name of the Chief Justice at that time. And so, there are certain kinds of cases that come before, and American history actually takes some changes on the basis of what actually happened. Now, let me tell you about Earl Warren, though, and why this is such a touching kind of case. Earl Warren was the governor of California during the Second World War. It was Earl Warren who signed the document that led to the internment of the Japanese-American families who lived on the West Coast. When Japan attacked Pearl Harbor and the United States became very frightened that Japan was going to attack, they developed this crazy idea that anybody who is Japanese might be a threat to the United States. Now, we had Japanese families on the West Coast, been there for generations. And yet, this kind of panic, this intense pressure developed, intense prejudice is what I should say. And so a document was put forward that we should separate all the Japanese people who lived on the West Coast because they might be in cahoots with the people in Japan. And so people who were American citizens were brought to camps. They were taken from their homes. And by the way, they weren't necessarily brought to camps in their neighborhood. I know Japanese people, for example, who lived in California all their life. They ended up in camps in Arkansas. They ended up in camps in Colorado. Now, Earl Warren signed this, and he never came to grips in his own life with what a horrible act it was that he had agreed to inter the Japanese Americans during the Second World War. And in fact, late in his life, you know, he indicated that he would never forgive himself for having done this. But it's very interesting because here's a man who did something that, you know, one could certainly see as about as racist a stance as you could take. But he knew he was wrong. I mean, this, you know, history, of course, showed he was terribly wrong. But when he became the Chief Justice, one cannot help but think that there was some drive in him to try to correct for the terrible injustice that he had inflicted on all the Japanese people who were in the United States during the Second World War. So he becomes the champion of Black America. And when you read the history, you'll see just fascinating, you know, what he did. Here is one article that you might want to read in The American Psychologist. It's by Ludie Benjamin. He wrote it in 2002, and you'll see it's in volume 57, pages 35 to 50. And he gives you a nice history of what the meaning to psychological science was of this case in the Supreme Court. But if you really want to read a terrific book, you want to read Simple Justice, The History of Brown versus the Board of Education and Black America's Struggle for Equality, written by Richard Kluger. Now, you may think this is an old book. This book reads like an adventure. This book captures the what happened with Thurgood Marshall and with the tremendous opposition Thurgood Marshall had to face in order to bring this case. It tracks what happened with Dr. Clark as he traveled through the South. And you begin to recognize, this Kluger did a tremendous job with this book, and you recognize how utterly frightening it was for Kenneth Clark to decide to gather these data and to visit these schools. Now, what's really interesting about this is, you know, eventually, people pointed out that this Dahl test had essentially no validity, you know, or reliability. I mean, nobody uses it today. Never was really scientifically developed anyway. And so we have probably the most powerful impact a psychological test has ever had in our culture, and it wasn't even a good test. And later, one of the things that happened, of course, is you began to see which psychologists were bigots, because lots of people began attacking Kenneth Clark on the grounds that this test wasn't really a very valid test, that we shouldn't pay a lot of attention to this, et cetera. Some prominent psychologists wrote public statements to that effect. While others pointed out that, you know, Clark was a real hero, that he demonstrated what many of us knew anyway, namely that this was a terrible system of education for Black children. And Kenneth Clark eventually became president of the American Psychological Association. So a lot, you know, came from this. And of course, Thurgood Marshall becomes becomes a justice in the Supreme Court. But I would tell you, if you read Kluger's book, you'll find that it's a fascinating adventure to read. Now, there also are just lots of tests that we might have discussed, but we don't have time in our course here to do it. But I want to, to really impress upon you that psychological testing is a very dynamic field. But it's a field that if you're going to work in it, you really have to spend a lot of time finding out the validity and the reliability of what you're doing. And psychology still is a field that's split in this way. There are some people who really spend their time, working very hard to make tests scientifically valid. And they can point to all kinds of statistical analyses that show you, the tests were very valid. There are others who feel that, this kind of clinical intuitive approach is just fine. That is, we don't have statistical evidence necessarily to support things we get from the TAT or the Rorschach at times or draw a person. But good clinicians get a lot of information from the tests that they're not able to get from interviews, and that the tests really help to embellish information from interviews. And the tests sometimes, the projective tests especially, help you to differentiate, whether someone falls into a very serious mental illness category versus perhaps a less serious mental illness category. And also, people feel that sometimes the tests help you to get a real understanding of a person's impulse life. That is, whether they're likely to act out. And of course, the two big things you become concerned about is, are they going to act out and hurt someone else, or are they going to hurt themselves? Okay. That's going to take care of psychological testing, unless there are questions you want to ask about it. Oh, sure, the Ludi Benjamin reference?
Yes.
Yes. Ludi Benjamin, by the way, is a psychologist who is a professor at Texas A&M. And he is probably the best known, or close to being the best known, historian of psychology. And he has out a marvelous book on the history of psychology, too. But this particular article is good. Okay, now then, we are going to move on, and we're going to return to talk about psychotherapy. And we actually have covered, much of what... we've really covered quite well, I think, the theories of psychotherapy and many of the strategies in psychotherapy. But there are some areas that we haven't gotten to yet. One of the things even we might just start with, to be sure we're all on the same page here, what is psychotherapy? I mean, when I say to you psychotherapy, what do you think? Your best guess.
I would say therapy, where you use one of the psychological theories to determine diagnosis and treatment for the patient.
Okay. So you feel if you're going to do psychotherapy, you're probably going to operate from some theory. And of course, we spend a lot of time discussing these theories. Okay, that's good. What else do you think about with psychotherapy? Any dimensions of it you want to mention? We spend a lot of time talking about psychotherapy. Sure.
Maybe choose going back to what she said, if you choose a different kind of approach, different kinds of approach in terms of psychotherapy, different kinds of treatment, different kinds of goals that you're looking towards, depending on who.
Okay, excellent. Yes. The situation in psychotherapy is that depending on the kind of problem the person presents may determine the kind of psychotherapy you'll do. And different therapies have different goals, and they have different approaches to how you might work at changing a person. Now, when you think of psychotherapy in a very broad way, you know, it's one of a number of interventions. I mean, there are different strategies, and if you recall, when we were going through theories, we pointed out that people approach the psychotherapy differently depending on the theoretical frame of reference they come by. Now also, we tend to think of psychotherapy as something that is delivered by a trained therapist. That not just anybody does psychotherapy, not just any interaction is psychotherapy. Psychotherapy takes place between a client or patient and a trained person who is seen as being able, perhaps being expert in working with certain problems. And of course, the purpose of psychotherapy is to alleviate symptoms or to alleviate problems and to usually, you know, create a better functioning person. Some might say, or a person at least who is in less pain than he or she is now in. Now, there are a number of characteristics about psychotherapy that we did not talk about before. We talked about psychotherapy in the context of theories, but most of what I'm going to say right now kind of generalizes to all of these theories. In psychotherapy, usually only one therapist is involved. Now, when we broaden the term to include group and family therapy, then you may have more than one therapist. You may have two therapists who are going to work with a group, or two therapists that are going to work with a family or a couple. Also, you know, the training of the therapist can be for several years. And that certainly is the case with clinical psychologists, with psychiatrists, and with psychoanalysts. Or the training can be for shorter periods of time, which is more often the case with social workers, psychiatric nurses, pastoral counselors, family therapists, and other kinds of interveners. Now, it's also important to acknowledge, especially in the case of social work, that sometimes social work, after their degree, pursue extensive training in psychotherapy, so they often have considerable background in psychotherapy. There also are about 250 types of psychotherapy. That's how many have been identified. But only a very small number of these 250 plus types actually have any kind of empirical validation. And so psychologists lately have been working very hard to examine what's the scientific basis for these various kinds of psychotherapy. Is there a scientific basis? Now, for many forms of psychotherapy, there is no scientific basis. It just somebody has developed an approach to trying to help people who are emotionally troubled. They claim it works. It has never been empirically tested. And what psychologists have been saying is if these interventions haven't been tested, and we really don't know if they work well or not, you should not teach them in graduate school. You should not be operating as if something that is scientifically validated and we know works on certain populations is not any different than something that is just a bright idea from people. And this, by the way, in psychology is doing two things. One is they're trying to say that you shouldn't teach in graduate school theories are not validated, but also they're saying you shouldn't use them in clinics and hospitals or in private practice, that we should stick to, in our treatment, those kinds of treatments that we actually can demonstrate work, that we owe that to the public, to not just try things. And you can imagine, of course, I mean, if your physician was treating you for an ulcer and said, I think I'll try this drug because I'm curious to see what would happen. And psychology is saying that must stop in psychotherapy. Okay, we're going to take a break now, and then we'll go on and we'll talk more about psychotherapy.